Welcome to another episode of Talks with T. I'm honored today to have Kunal Kapoor, founder of the Luxury Closet and CEO. I think we've known each other through kind of the tech space for some time, but I haven't had the pleasure of digging deep into your wisdom. So thanks for taking the time today.
Welcome. Thank you for having me. And yes, I have signs of wisdom, which is my graying beard. And I hope there is more to it than that. So we'll find out.
How would you describe the Luxury Closet for our listeners who aren't familiar with it?
So the Luxury Closet is a marketplace for consumers to buy and sell luxury items, mostly fashion. So bags, shoes, watches, jewelry, other accessories. And it's really focused on the luxury space and the luxury customer.
Yeah.
So we then are on a mission to unlock the best closets in the world, which happen to be in Dubai and in the Middle East, and bring out those items to give them a second life. Once we do, we find buyers from around the world. Because we end up giving a second life to some of the most amazing collectibles and products, ones that are meant to last generations.
Nice. Yeah. And we were chatting briefly before the show started. So you grew up in India and ended up in the US for university. I'd love to hear the story of, you know, you had mentioned that you went to the US because you want to work with a Microsoft or an Apple. But that's not what you ended up doing. So tell me the story about your journey post university.
So my father is an entrepreneur. Yeah. And I thought that was like really fascinating, like amazing to build companies. Now he was, let's say, into manufacturing. So he had a different life. But when I saw like my first computer, I was like, well, I was totally fixated and fascinated.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to do something different, which was to be a tech entrepreneur. Yeah. And I think I did that fascination started very early, like 13, 14 years old, when I had my first 386.
Nice.
So I wanted to go work in the tech space in the US. And that meant I had to figure out how to move from India to US. Yeah. And college was like the right bridge. Yeah. So I went to a small liberal arts college in the US called Knox, because they gave me a small scholarship and that aided it. And it was an amazing space. It was an amazing place to learn, where I would say, I think, while I was studying computer science and economics, I was also studying photography. So let's say I would spend half my time writing code and the other half my time taking photographs and printing them myself.
Yeah.
So that's a good, how should I say, two very important influences in my life, very relevant today, because that's kind of the space we're in, right? So we're in the technology space, but also one that is luxury, which is, you know, got a lot to do with aesthetics. Mm-hmm. So I studied in the US for 4 years with the aim of trying to get a job in one of the tech companies, ideally Microsoft. Ended up interviewing for Microsoft, which started with me telling them how badly their clock was designed. Because back then, you remember, 95, you could just open the clock and change the system time.
Yeah.
Which was so totally silly. Like, you just three clicks and you just change the system time. So that's what was my first interview. And they were like, product manager. Yeah. But I got an offer from my dad, which was the worst offer, but the best offer. Yeah. And I decided to take that. It involved getting free stay, free food, because I stayed with my parents, a car, so I didn't have to buy one, hand-me-down car, but limitless potential in trying to work with him and grow the business. So rather than going and working in the tech space, I ended up becoming a second generation shoemaker, went to shoe school. Our graduation ceremony was, the test was to make 5 pairs of shoes from scratch. So, you know, you cut the leather, you design the patterns. And that led to an understanding of how products are manufactured. Yeah. I ended up making the 5 worst shoes ever made.
Do you still have them?
No, I don't. Completely unsellable. I don't know what happened to them. But that is also important because, you know, when I saw, you know, what Louis Vuitton and what Bali makes, I mean, yeah. I was in love. I was like, oh my God, that is just perfection.
Mm.
Yeah. How do I get one? How do I get more than one?
Yeah.
So, and that kind of was an early influence as well. That led to where I am today.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about business entrepreneurship from working with your dad?
Mainly it's tough, but rewarding.
Mm. Yeah.
And so it's challenging and it can really pay off as a very satisfying experience, and also financially rewarding experience if you get it right.
Mm.
So I think that was it. When I saw the tech founders do it, I also saw how many people you could influence. You could really create something and you could really create a following and you can really change an industry.
Mm.
So I wanted to do that at scale.
Yeah, yeah. And working with your dad, what are things you saw him do in his business that you've taken on? And what are things that you saw him do that you said, I'm never going to do that when I eventually start my own business?
That's a really good question. Yeah. So I'll go back to saying he taught me how to stick with it. Yeah. That there's ups and downs, and somehow during the downs, you figure so many things out that are pivotal to leading the next wave up. Mm. Right. And then in terms of management, I decided to do things differently, yeah, because he was an entrepreneur. He was the traditional boss, right?
Yeah.
But that, let's say, doesn't work in the tech space. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had to do things differently to recruit really talented people.
Yeah.
You know, give them the opportunity to make decisions. Even in spaces where they know better, right?
Yeah.
So how do you build an environment where people who are very talented and experts can thrive?
Yeah. Mm.
So that led to a different work culture and management style.
Yeah. And how do you describe your management style now?
So I'd say focus on the long term.
Mm.
Constantly, never lose sight of the long term. So the vision is very, very important because that lets you see beyond today. Lets you see beyond the obstacles that are there today and focus on the place that you could get to.
Yeah.
So I think that vision has to be very, very clear. And that vision has to be clear in multiple places. Yeah. Mm. So it's not just like the industry, but you know, when you think about what does the site look like? How does it function? So just down to multiple core drivers of that vision, it has to be very, very clear. The second I would say is very roadmap based. So it's a Scrum approach, which is you break that down into 5 years, into a year, into quarter, into months, into day.
Mm.
So it's always about do we know where we need to be in the quarter, the month, but then what do we do today?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I say that's second. And then third is it's a bit more democratic than what, I don't know. I think it's a self-balancing system where I don't want to, so once that is done, once there's a vision, once there's a roadmap, I don't want to make the call.
Yeah.
So I want people to decide to the best of kind of the possibility.
Yeah.
And I want to speak last. Now, the thing is, I have a lot of ideas.
Yeah.
So I like to kind of get in there and say, you know, what about this and what about that?
Yeah.
But then I try not to make as less decisions as possible. I think if I make a few good decisions in a week, I think that is great.
Yeah. And how do you, let's say you have a lot of ideas and you have an opinion. How do you balance that with And in some cases, you may believe that this idea or this opinion is critical to the success of the project, the initiative, the company. How do you balance that with giving autonomy to the team?
That's a good one. So, look, I think first, I think it depends. So I think it depends upon you come up with something which is, let's say it's not something small. It's something that's got to do with the strategic direction of the company.
Mm.
Then I think the most important question is, what do people around you think?
Mm.
Yeah. So if you're the only one who's like, okay, you know what? This is what needs to be done, and everybody's like, no, this is not what needs to be done. I think you need to find somebody who does think you're right. Mm. Now, sometimes what happens is that it's either a board member or it's somebody from my team, ideally, yeah? In some instances, and this is very, very rare, it's somebody outside. So it's another founder, or it's another team member who's not yet in the team but needs to be in the team.
Yeah. Mm.
So long story short, you need to find a team member who believes that this is the right direction.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you need to do that with.
Mm.
I don't believe that it will ever work if, let's say, it's something which is extremely important strategically, yeah, technology, and the CTO does not agree with me and the head of product does not agree with me. Yeah. So it's never going to happen, yeah? Because, yeah, it's just never going to happen, yeah?
No.
So, but I've been in situations where I'm like, you know what? Everybody's wrong. I am right.
Mm.
But I need that somebody else who believes I'm right to execute with me,
yeah?
And that leads to a complete change in the people you work with, yeah?
Mm.
So find a teammate who will work with you, who believe in something and work with you. I think that's the most important thing.
And how do you differentiate? So this might be a bit of a detailed question, but I'm asking for my own benefit. How do you determine if someone believes in you as Kunal and is just going to go with you because they believe in you versus they actually believe in the idea? And that could happen more with teammates, right? Some, especially in the early days, teammates join because they believe in the founder.
Mm-hmm.
And they have some conviction about the idea, but they're just drawn by the founder.
Or it could be the opposite way around.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it is... ideally, somebody believes in both.
Yeah.
But when somebody's joining, they don't know. So they're making a bet.
Yeah.
They've done their due diligence on the idea, you know, that this could really work and this is interesting because people are leaving normally higher paying jobs, to come to work in a startup. And through that experience, they've realized that they can work with you, and that you are a partner to make it happen.
Mm.
But I don't want them coming in believing I have a magic stick and I'm going to wave things and that's going to happen. Mm. I want them to come in believing they have a magic stick and they're going to wave it and then things are going to happen.
Yeah.
But they have the right platform.
Mm.
They have the right founder and they have the right team to make that happen.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of both.
Yeah. Gotcha.
And I want them to believe that they have a magic stick.
Yeah. And why did you decide to do your MBA? You're aspiring shoemaker to a certain extent and in the manufacturing industry. Why did you decide that it was time to do an MBA?
Career pivot. Okay. Again. So I was working with in a family business and I was like, look, I've spent 5-6 years here. Maybe I could do something myself. My family was very supportive. So I decided to go to business school. Yeah. Also, I'd worked really hard for 5-6 years, and I was like, "Okay, you know what? Now, time to do something different." Yeah.
And post your MBA, you ended up working with LVMH, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So that was a super interesting experience. Yeah. So here I am. I go to business school. I go to INSEAD, which is like a difficult to get into, well-known business school, and you know, I. it's near Paris. It's in the forest, but Paris. So you go to Paris, and you know, you get to go see more of these products that you're trying to come close to, and you know, you fall more in love with the craft and the industry and the brands. And that was it. I really wanted to work in luxury. Yeah. So Louis Vuitton gave me a position, but they gave me an interesting offer. Yeah? To get anywhere in the company, you have to start from the store. Yeah. The example was Yves Carcel, who was the CEO of Louis Vuitton at the time, went to INSEAD and then he went to work in a store. So how could you refuse that offer? So I took that offer. I started in the Mall of Emirates, working as a sales manager, managing a team and revenue, and you know, meeting the customers and getting even closer to the product, learning more about the industry. And it was a brilliant, brilliant place to learn.
Amazing.
It was an incredible learning experience. And that's where kind of, the idea to come up with the luxury closet came about, right? And it became even stronger. Because there, I was... first, so I wanted to buy these products. Yeah, I saw these products, but I could not afford them.
Yeah,
one day I saw this shoe, and it was like this beautiful tan Louis Vuitton Baroque, and I looked at the price, and I was like, "Oh my God, it's like 3,000 dirhams for that shoe."
Yeah,
which is a significant percent of my salary.
Yeah.
And I just hoped that no one bought it.
Yeah.
So try to unsell that shoe to anybody who came. So that when it came time for the destocking and the employee sale, I could get that shoe.
Yeah.
And I was extremely lucky. I still remember that. I still have that shoe.
Amazing.
Like 13, 14 years later, and it's still amazing. And when I got there and when I wore it, I just felt amazing. I was like, oh my God, I just feel so great.
Yeah.
And that led to, again, how do I get more of these things, right? Yeah. Now, also I met the customers, and when I met the customers, let's say broadly, they came in two distinct sets, customers like me who wanted to own another pair of the shoe or another bag or another something like this. And then customers who were our core customers, our most valued customers, who were really collectors and connoisseurs, and they would buy nearly every single collection. Yeah.
Mm.
And I wondered, how big are those closets?
Yeah.
And how often do they get to wear those products?
Yeah.
And my guess was the closets are large and they're not wearing the products very often. And I was like, what if, you know, what if other people could get access to this? At the same time, I was seeing people gather outside the store trying to create a transaction. They would meet on, I don't know, Dubazil.
Yeah.
They'd come outside the store. They would like talk and they would like negotiate. They would show the product to each other. And they would come into the store and say, can you tell us this is real or not?
Yeah.
Which we're not allowed to do. And, you know, looking for an authentication confirmation, after which they would go and exchange the money. Yeah.
Mm.
So I saw this behavior and I was like, it doesn't work. Like there's a complete dysfunction. Yeah?
Yeah.
Also, I saw products, like I saw people standing outside the door. Sometimes I had to go and close the door because there was too many people and too much demand. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Imagine that we could get a much larger inventory of products from closets because there's more products in closets around the world than in showrooms around the world. Yeah. There are $3 trillion of items sitting in closets around the world. Yeah.
Mm.
What if we could get access to them? And what if all these Louis Vuitton items was 50% off?
Yeah.
What would happen? So there was like this explosion of like, oh my, enthusiasm. And I was like, that's what I have to do.
And did you always, it seems, talking to you, it's very clear that you actually have a genuine passion for the underlying product, which is, you know, a luxury item. Did that come from working with your dad? Did that come at a different stage in your life?
Yeah, so that came with the working with my dad and building shoes and later clothing products. Yeah.
And to a certain extent, what role does everything can be a tech company now, right? But the underlying industry, you're in the luxury industry at the end of the day. You're a tech company, but you're in the luxury industry. How important or what factor do you think it plays having a passion for the underlying industry versus in this context, you know, having an underlying appreciation for luxury versus saying I have an appreciation for tech, which is kind of the layer on top?
Look, I think a founder needs to understand the customer, needs to understand the product that they're transacting, and needs to understand technology, which is how you're going to then get those customers to transact those products at much more ease, better pricing, or, you know, bring something that hasn't been bought already, right? So I think it takes an understanding of all three to then build something unique, and then have kind of this vision, which may be different to the industry, where you spot something that is, you know, not being done, but then becomes important. And then you kind of stay ahead because you understand the three most important components.
And so you go from this idea that you're in the showroom and you say, this is my calling. Walk me through how you execute, go from A to B.
Well, next I saw that Milan Station went public on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, which was the pre-owned handbag retailer in Hong Kong. And so while thinking about this, I see this like proof of success.
Yeah, validation.
And I was like, well, if Milan Station can go public on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, I can go public on, I don't know, the Dubai Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
So that was the trigger to kind of leave my job and then jump into this. Started off in my apartment, one computer, no employees, doing everything I myself.
Were you doing both? Were you doing the Louis Vuitton job and doing
I decided to leave. Yeah. Because the passion and enthusiasm was so much. I don't think I would be doing justice to my job. Yeah. And also, like, coming from an entrepreneurial family, they were like, yay, you know, congratulations, go, let's do this.
That's amazing to have that kind of support system.
No, absolutely. It was my parents. Yeah. My sister who gave me my first bag to sell.
Yeah.
And my wife who paid the rent. So that was the kind of the support system back then.
Yeah.
And when I started, I built the site by myself. I did the whole process by myself. So found the seller, met the seller, got the product from the seller, uploaded the products from my seller, you know, advertised myself, created the transaction myself. And there was, I had a working product and it was profitable.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had to sell a bag a day.
Yeah.
To be at a run rate of nearly $500,000 a year in annualized run rate.
Yeah.
And once I had that and I took it to Middle East Venture Partners, they were pretty eager to back it. And that's how the fork of owning the company 100% and kind of following it the same way as my dad did, or, you know, taking the venture capital route, I decided to take then the venture capital route.
How did, walk me through your thought process. How did you decide that was the route to take?
I had walked that path with my father.
Yeah.
I wanted to see what the other one was like. It was really quite simple.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I wanted to see how, if I had access to capital, much more than retained profits and, you know, I don't know, bank loans, what could this turn into?
And, you know, I feel that in today's day and age, that it's default fundraise versus default, is fundraising appropriate for my business model or my business ambitions or not?
That's correct.
And now, based on your experience, what is the lens through which a founder should look to say, you know, should I be bootstrapping this? Should I be fundraising?
So, look, I think the question is, how long should I be bootstrapping this? And then how much should I be fundraising? Because even in small businesses, you need access to capital. Yeah. And in the UAE, it's pretty difficult to get debt, you know, which in other countries would be normal to get something. It's a lot more personal risk involved, yeah? So that's it. I think that, and the answer for me is that I think you should bootstrap until you have a working product, you have revenue, maybe not team, and then you should be very wise about how much you fundraise, and especially kind of in the climate that we're in,
yeah,
it makes you think whether all of this capital is really necessary or good for your business.
Mm. Mm. Can you elaborate on that last piece, whether or not the capital is good for your business?
Yeah, so look, we're in a... I'm seeing... Okay, I log into LinkedIn. Let me turn this into a story.
Yeah.
And I see kind of a change in public...
discourse.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right? Where, you know, one of the lines is, hey, listen, all of the startup founders have turned into chief EBITDA officers. Yeah. Then I see another really funny... meme about this car going up a mountain, very steep slope, very narrow, and then trying to make a U-turn and then going down.
Yeah.
So essentially, this is where we are, right? We're in a phase where growth at all costs is not what is the aim. So and it's time to just stop and say, listen. How much can I tune to profitability?
Mm.
So it's and then when you start doing that, you start wondering, hey, listen, why didn't I do some of these things before?
Mm.
Why was I subsidizing some of these purchases?
Mm.
It makes you question the things, and maybe find the right formula. Maybe find a better formula.
I think to a large extent. When we've been forced by forces outside of our control to take tough decisions or to really look at our capital in a different perspective, the upside of doing that always was greater than our expectation, and the downside was never as bad as we thought it would be, right? And so when you're forced sometimes to do that, it's a good exercise because the outcome ends up being, you know, far superior than you would have anticipated. And I think to a large extent, many founders are being forced to go through that exercise now. But I think generally speaking, the whole ecosystem will come out better for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So okay, I think it's good to have a capital, and it's good to, you know, kind of push the limits on growth and say, listen, to just figure out the drivers of growth and your how capital and talent impacts each of those drivers of growth.
Yeah.
And then it's also important to just turn around and look at the drivers of cost.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then how can you really rightly configure it?
Yeah.
And then when you combine the two together, yeah, that should be the, let's say, the right blend.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so you get that first investment from a VC. How does that, and you started to a large extent, I think in 2012, if I'm not mistaken. So this is even kind of pre an ecosystem being alive in the Middle East. And so how do you go about building an online business in 2012?
Well, the same way that you do it now. the ecosystem was weaker.
Yeah.
So there was, MVP with a $10 million fund with, I don't know how many, like 15, 20 companies in there.
Yeah.
And I mean, hats off to those guys. They did a good job.
Yeah.
There's still talent. You just have to... you get less experienced people. It's harder to find the right.
Yeah, it was less sexy back then to say, I'm working at a startup. Then
that too, yeah. So, and that affects the
talent.
I remember like trying to find a chief marketing officer, and I think like I got it right on the fourth. So I gave like one offer. The person said never showed up. Second offer accepted, never showed up. Third offer accepted, never showed up. Fourth time I was like, I'm gonna give two offers.
Yeah.
So I gave two offers, both accepted, and I was like, at least one will show up. And then both showed up, and I had to then manage. I remember having a team meeting saying, "Yeah, listen, we have Batman and we have Superman. Who are we gonna pick?" And that was a super interesting discussion. And they're both in; they both can start tomorrow. So, that was interesting. Yeah. But one of the ways we solved it is to start an office in India early. Mm. Mm. And that market was very different, is very different. Mm. There were a ton of companies, even in 2014, 2015, yeah. that had scaled e-commerce companies. So there was a lot of know-how that we could tap into, mm. and talent. Mm.
That was your engineering Correct. Team that yeah. you built there. And what sticks out kind of in that early period as problems you had to solve for that you really feel that changed the trajectory or made the trajectory go the way you wanted it in the growth story of Luxury Closet?
So I think the most important thing we had to figure out is how to build technology. Mm. Yeah. Back then, I remember having, just a few developers and just mm. even thinking about how to do product and which the simple thing about how do you prioritize? Like, because, yeah. you know, back then it's a very wide scope that mm. the business that the business manages and the technology platform manages. Yeah. So we have sellers and buyers,
yeah.
consumers, individual consumers on both end. And we offer a wide gloved service to both the buyer and the seller. Yeah. Which means on the seller's behalf, all they have to do is leave a telephone number and we do everything. So picking up the item, pricing it, authenticating it, doing the content, getting it online, selling it then to buyers across now 80 countries a year.
Oh, wow.
And doing all of the returns, print management, currencies, fraud. So there's just so many problems to solve. Mm. Then there is learning which problem to solve first, how to solve it really, really well.
Yeah.
And then kind of just building on like and how to build technology properly so it just, it doesn't take you steps backward, it just works every single release more or less works. Yeah. Mm. I heard Elon Musk saying recently that you're not building fast enough unless you have to roll back like half the time, which is that was the early days. Yeah. I would not agree with him now. But just getting that, learning how to get that right, is really, really important. And then, for this to become completely embedded in the company, every single team is thinking about which problems to solve, how to solve them, what's the best way to solve them, when to solve them, and understanding the effort, impact, measuring the impact. I think that is the company today. And just getting that process right has been the biggest change in the company.
Yeah. Yeah, and how do you drive that across the company? I think, you know, when it's yourself and a couple of engineers, it's obviously...
Yeah, that's a very good one. So on day one, it was like, we're like, okay, guys, you know what? We're going to do this exercise. Write your ideas on a post-it note, okay? And then you bring it into this room and you tell us why this idea is important, okay? That was an entire day's exercise where the whole team is coming with post-it notes and they're saying, listen, this is really important to do, putting everything on a board, and then figuring out, you know, how many people asked for the same thing. So maybe that's twice as important. Yeah. Hey, listen, somebody asked for this. Three people asked for this. That's thrice as important. So that was kind of like the day one of learning how to prioritize. Yeah. Then we went to taking that electronic, people sending in the requests, doing weighted votes. You know, the stream owner has 2x votes. Yeah. Kunal has 2x votes. Yeah. The whole company has 1x vote.
Yeah.
So that we kind of get the priority right. Then where we are today, that the product and technology team are so well integrated into the business that they come up with a roadmap, you know, which is more or less right. I mean, 80-90% is completely right. They really pinned down the main problems. They prioritized the problems again. They measured everything.
Yeah.
And then they go about building it. Yeah. But the whole company is building. Yeah.
You said, you know, one of the most, the way you look at scaling the business or building a business that's disruptive to a certain extent is understanding the underlying product, tech, and then customer. We've spent a little bit of time talking about tech. how do you stay close to the customer as the as a company scales, especially in the context of an e-commerce business?
So, well, there's what we did again in the early days and what we do now.
Yeah.
What we do now is for every single stream, we run an NPS survey. And we see in different cuts where the detractors are. And then we use that as problem statements. We do another interesting exercise that we call, and this is I got it from Airbnb. So we call the customer and say, listen, how would you rate the luxury closet? They say, 7. I say, okay, what can we do to make it 8?
Yeah.
And they say, oh, you know what? If the product came one day earlier, I would have given you 8. And I said, thank you very much. What would it take to get a 9? And the person goes, you know what? If there was less plastic in the packaging, I would have given you a 9. Like, that's great. That's a great suggestion. Thanks. What would it take to get a 10? And you stretch it to 11, you stretch it to 12, and stretch it to 13 until the customer, there's nothing to say. Yeah. But at 12, 13, you start getting things that are wow moments that the customer is really not expecting. And some of those wow moments can be embedded into the experience. And the Airbnb example there is the wine bottle, right?
Yeah.
So I think at 12, 13, people started saying, you know what, if I came in and, you know, there was a wine bottle waiting for me, that'll be amazing because I'm so not expecting that. And then said, you know what, wine bottle costs $2. Let's just ask everybody to put it in. Maybe we can charge for it.
Yeah.
Add it to the price.
Yeah.
So that takes it down there. So this way we collect.
And who typically makes those calls? The product manager, business leader?
So let's say, so there's a, you know, there's the seller NPS, there's the buyer NPS and the employee NPS. Yeah. So there are three key owners of the NPS who are then looking into this and, you know, kind of presenting what they think is right. And then, of course, that integrates with the product prioritization process, which then leads to deciding what we're going to work on.
And I guess, you know, today you mentioned that you're in over 80 countries, which is amazing to see. I think I've heard before from you that you always had this idea of building a company based in Dubai, but had a global impact. I'd love to learn a little bit more about some of the things you've learned about building a global business from the Middle East.
So my example was Emirates. You know, when you take an Emirates flight and then you kind of get used to this amazing experience, you know, it's super global. It's the best in the world. Then the question becomes, hey, listen, can I do something? Can I do something similar? I would love to do it. And I think that there are the ingredients here that allow you or kind of push you to do it. And then I think you merge that with the business and personal ambition and you can build something global and world class from Dubai. Yeah. So how it relates to us is that first we go out and we meet with customers and we work with customers who are they're the top customers of the top brands. Yeah. So what they demand from us is the very best. So you start trying to, you start serving a customer who is demanding the very best from day one. Yeah. Now how I solve for that is that I did everything myself on day one. I wore a suit and made the delivery.
Yeah.
You know, I went to do the home pickups. I wrote the thank you cards. Yeah. So anything that was needed for a very small set of customers, I'll have my phone number. You know, it's the best service that I could personally manage.
Yeah.
Of course, now that you have to scale that, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
So we start with the customer who demands the best. Yeah. We start with the kind of the industry, again, which is very high level of service. The luxury business is a business of like micro detail. Yeah. So you just have to keep up to that. Yeah. So which means that when you see a product, online at the luxury closet, it tells you the product, tells you all of the condition, tells you all the, are there any scratches on the product? Yeah. What is the dimensions of the product? When was the product made? What is the condition of the product?
Mm.
Yeah, all of this. What is the inclusions? Does it come with a box? Does it come with a, you know, a ribbon? Mm. You know, yeah. There's a ribbon included. Yeah, it's an original ribbon.
Yeah.
So we've had to build a business where details are really, really important.
Mm.
Yeah. And then third is you also start serving a global set of customers. Yeah.
Mm.
So you have all kinds of customers on day one, because it's a very metropolitan
yeah.
city.
Yeah.
And that gives you kind of the right base to build something, I would say world-class.
Mm.
Now, what we found is that when we put this online, because the World Wide Web, you can get it from anywhere, we started getting demand from everywhere.
Yeah. Which is something you weren't expecting.
Expecting in my first month start getting orders from the US.
Yeah.
And to hit a 50 country mark within a few years,
yeah.
And now it's like, you know, people are ordering from 80 plus countries across the world.
Yeah.
Our second largest country of destination is actually the United States.
Mm.
Yeah. And there's Australia and UK and, you know, so on and so forth. Yeah. So, you know, you build something for high standards, the very best demands from the customers, and you can build something really good. So as it turns out, we've become the second largest luxury marketplace globally.
Wow.
You know, there's the Real in the US, which is again less average order value than us, but it is the largest. It is the highest average basket of any multi-category marketplace. So if you sell watches, maybe you're higher.
Yeah.
But if you sell more than one product, more than one category,
yeah.
it's the highest basket in the world. Yeah,
that's amazing.
We came out with this focus on luxury, and we did it. I think we do it really better than anyone else in the world.
Yeah. I can imagine that a lot of people would say you can't do ultra luxury, high quality service, and get that experience right at such a large scale across multiple countries. I can imagine a lot of people
It's not easy, definitely, right?
Yeah.
So finding service providers who would do delivery, currencies, trying to like just optimize acceptance rates for international countries took a long time because half the transactions would fail. Wouldn't even have a UAE bank trying to, you know, try at the back.
Yeah.
I'm trying to like get these transactions outside.
Yeah. I guess my point is, there's more reasons why this wouldn't be possible than it would be possible to accomplish this. So how do you work through that noise to say, actually, no, I have the conviction that the idea I have can go from idea into reality?
But as I just described, the thinking is the opposite. You start with saying, hey, this should totally be possible.
Okay. Yeah. So it's the mindset from the get-go.
Yes, or you're foolish, or you're
naive,
or you know. I did not start with thinking that this is not possible. Yeah, I just perhaps didn't have the chance to. Let's say I got the traction before I had the chance to, you know,
question it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You think about the problem and try to work on the problem.
Yeah.
But it's totally doable from Dubai.
Yeah.
It's one of the best places in the world to build a global business.
I've heard you say a couple of things today. This idea of, you know, what I wrote down is think of what's possible always instead of what's not possible. This idea of, you know, this iterative questioning with customers to really build a world-class experience. Very succinctly put, to build a business, you have to know product, deep understanding of your customer, and deep understanding of technology. In terms of getting the team around an idea, really you need to find someone who buys into it to be able to execute it within a company. And the first idea you start with, which is, you know, the downs really teach you how to lead in the next wave of the company. And so I've learned a ton from chatting with you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to have the conversation today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun chat.